Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Governor Kim Reynolds delivered a 43-minute condition of the state address to a joint convention of the Iowa House and Senate yesterday. It was the first ever by a woman in the state's history. Reynolds laid out her agenda for the upcoming legislative session, and she also took on the issue of sexual harassment. The state had to pay out nearly $2 million to a Republican Senate staffer because of sexual harassment charges earlier this year.
Iowans are watching. We can't change behavior everywhere, but we have an obligation to lead. And as long as I'm governor, we're going to.
Reynolds says she hopes her governorship will inspire women and girls to pursue their dream. She went on to praise the condition of the state and reviewed the accomplishments of Iowa's Republican majority, and mostly Republicans applauded her. Those accomplishments included curbing collective bargaining, strengthening gun rights, voter ID laws, and limiting abortions. Reynolds went on to outline plans to improve water quality, boost services for the mentally ill, try to deal with opioid abuse, and those issues won bipartisan approval. Reynolds said she'll also offer a bill this year to try and simplify and cut individual income taxes only.
When the federal government cuts taxes for farmers and small businesses, Iowa raises taxes on farmers and small businesses. And that's not just a hypothetical. It's what will happen if we don't act.
Reynolds also talked about a new initiative that will be led by Acting Lieutenant Governor Adam Gregg to explore improvements for rural Iowa. After the speech, I spoke with Woodbury County Republican Party member Susan Stewart and Woodbury County Democratic Party member Jim Mullen and got their impressions. First, you'll hear Susan Stewart.
Well, this is her first speech, and I thought she delivered it very well. I thought she also focused on a lot of high-level, really big proposals, tax reform, water quality, a lot on job training. But of course, when it's early in the session, we are all positive. It'll be, I'm not sure whether she'll have a separate budget address, but I'll be interested in seeing some of these bills.
Right, Rick?
Well, you know, a lot of the things that she's talking about are the things that have bipartisan support. You know, the opioid addiction, broadband in rural areas, mental health services. The problem is Republicans don't usually fund those things. So she talks nicely about them, but nothing is actually going to probably happen.
She did talk quite a bit about trying to do something about health care, about Medicaid privatization that she and other Republicans have caught a lot of heat for over the last year, saying mistakes were made. She's made new hires. They're going to try and do something to fix the problems with this. Rick, what do you think about her comments there?
Well, she's talking about adding, you know, $54 million for education. That
right.
Sounds nice, but it goes extremely short of what's actually needed. Last year, the school systems across the state needed over 3% increase just to stay even, and the Iowa legislature only gave them slightly over 1%. So you've seen that impact here at Western Iowa Tech. We've seen it in Sioux City Community Schools and all the other schools across Iowa. There simply is not adequate funding for education, no matter what she's saying today.
Mm-hmm. Education, healthcare. Susan, what do you think?
Well, I think we have to look at one of the parts of her speech indicates that funding is at a all-time high. Iowa funds its schools about as well as almost any other state in the country. There are a lot of interesting proposals she made that may bring some new resources to education. She talks about coupling with the private sector, and I know I worked in the utility industry, and there are a lot of efforts in that industry to get new blood into a lot of the positions. Hopefully she can leverage those kinds of private funds to state funds. I would also point out there are other ways to do things. The state doesn't have to do broadband. The state has passed some laws that incent broadband and to be implemented in the state. So there are a lot of ways other than just opening up the checkbook that these can be accomplished.
Now, but the problem is that the education funding in particular is a critical need. Tax cuts have grown six times faster than education funding. They're cutting more money out of the budget by giving it away to huge corporations, Apple, the Egyptian fertilizer company, huge amounts of money to create very few jobs in Iowa, and that leaves very little money left for critical things like mental health care, education, all the other things that Iowans really need.
And clearly that's something that's going to come up, I think, a lot in the legislative session. Democrats have been talking about this since last session. So,
well, I will point out that I remember the film industry tax credits that the Democrats championed. I think our city thrives on historical tax credits and targeted job tax credits. I think what we have to look at, as opposed to talking about bad tax credits, is that the governor is setting up a task force that's going to make recommendations to her. She's setting it up, so it is going to be a public body where people can hear what they're saying and make comments. And I think that's, it may be kicking it down the road, but she's kicking it down the road the right way.
Well, the film board thing was not good, but it was a tiny fraction of the hundreds of millions of dollars that the Branstad and Reynolds administrations have given away to huge corporations. They have not resulted in large numbers
of
dollars.
But I will have to say, I think we both know and love, both parties know and love certain tax credits and hate other ones.
Yeah, it depends on which side of the aisle you're on, I suppose. In tax reform, she said she has plans to make some major changes. It's not this year, though. Do you think that's going to disappoint people?
Well, it is going to be a very difficult thing to accomplish, and the devil is always in the details. Iowa does have a tax system that makes it appear like we have high tax rates.
Yes.
The actual rates that businesses pay is much smaller, but it doesn't look good on the charts that people use to compare Iowa to other states. So, yes, I understand the need to do that, to tighten up some things and to make some changes. But the problem is that a lot of the people that the Republicans are bringing in as their experts are the same people that caused Kansas to completely decimate their economy by slashing their taxes, which meant that schools had to close early and basic infrastructure things could not be met.
That's the state that's always mentioned.
And we don't want Iowa to turn into another Kansas.
Right.
And instead of talking about Kansas, I think we need to look at what she said. She did not say she's kicking this down the road to next year. We have a unique opportunity with the Federal Tax Act to make some changes. I think she's talking about kicking corporate tax rates down to next year, but implementing individual tax rates so Iowans really do end up with more money in their paycheck. I think this is a real unique opportunity, like Rick said, to make some changes. The Wall Street Journal put Iowa in the same category as Connecticut and some of the very high tax states that everyone knows about. I do think we in Siouxland need to stem the march of people to South Dakota, which is just going to continue as tax abatement goes out on a local level. And I think she's going to make some changes that hopefully will help this year.
You know, I thought that she laid out some fairly good plans in terms of trying to do something about mental health care, the pilot program she talked about to increase access to what she called subacute beds so people could get help when they need help and not have to wait. Also, with the opioid addiction, trying to reduce the number of opioid prescriptions, monitoring, and treatment. Rick, what did you think of her ideas with those?
Opioid crisis is astonishing. I talked to a local nurse practitioner a few days ago, and I was just astonished at some of the stories I heard. So yes, we all agree that something needs to be done, and I hope that our legislature can work together to help solve this problem. It's a national problem, but it directly affects people here. It also has something to do with the mental health system in Iowa, which was completely decimated by Governor Branstad. Closing three major mental health institutions in Iowa has not helped. It's caused the least of us to have the most problems. And that we really need to be looking at that very, very hard and trying to find ways to provide real services to people who really need it right here in Sioux City.
Susan, we've had some, you know, issues here with being in a regional mental health system. Everyone in the state has sort of switched to this.
Correct. I don't think anyone can disagree that mental health is a priority. We have had these regions that have started in business in 2013. I think some of these initiatives will be things that can be well handled by the regions. The one plug I would make for Siouxland is that the governor talked about adding to psychiatrists' education at Des Moines University. We do have the Siouxland Mental Health Education Foundation that also trains a lot of family practice residents, and I'm hoping that perhaps her program can extend to them as well, and we can continue to add more resources, doctors, subacute beds, throughout the state, not just at a couple of institutions. Mm.
I would like to ask, do you either one of you think that lawmakers will try and take action on the issues with Medicaid privatization as the weeks come on? Do you think there's not enough time to do anything with that, or they don't have the, you know, the backing or the power they need to make that happen?
I do know the Democrats introduced, I think the one committee introduced a bill that basically would repeal privatization.
Right.
And it also addresses individual mandates. But to date, privatization has saved a lot of money. I think the governor acknowledged the problems. She's been acknowledging the issues from appointing Director Foxhoven almost after she was elected or appointed or became governor, however you want to put it. And she acknowledged today there are issues and that she's going to deal with them. There have been savings to date already. There continue to be savings. So I don't know how the Democratic proposal will go, but...
Well, we know that that what Branstad and Reynolds have done has been a failure. It's leaving the most vulnerable behind. And some of the Band-Aids they're talking about really aren't going to fix it. I think she brought in the head of Kansas's Medicaid team to Iowa, and we know what a treat Kansas has been, so I hope that we can do better.
That was Woodbury County Republican Party member Susan Stewart and Woodbury County Democratic Party member Jim Mullen talking about Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds' condition of the state speech yesterday. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. This week, former 6th District House Representative Jim Carlin was sworn in as the 3rd District Senator from Siouxland. The two candidates for his open seat are veteran educator and principal in the Sioux City Community School District, Democrat Rita DeYoung, and a staffer for Republican Iowa U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Jacob Bossman. The election is next Tuesday, January 16th. DeYoung has had strong support from local Democrats as well as a national postcard writing effort. Postcards to Voters founder Tony McMullen says the group targets special elections around the country where there's a chance to flip a seat from Republican to Democrat. McMullen says the postcards can make a big difference to average voters who need a little reminder about voting.
Our cards are fully handwritten, individual, personalized. They're written by volunteers who some will do as few as five. And some might do 25. They sometimes write them on their own at home by themselves, or they might get together with friends, and some of them get together and organize postcard parties where they might invite complete strangers to come by, a restaurant or Starbucks or, you know, someplace and write cards for a couple of hours. So that's what we write, and then the voters that we write to are Democratic voters in key or close elections around the country that show up on our radar for whatever different reason it might be. We've written in city council elections, school boards, up to congressional, and everything in between. The criteria is not so much what is the office as it is what is the opportunity to help a Democratic candidate flip a seat, generally speaking, you know, to flip it from a Republican held seat to a Democratic held seat, with the benefit of just a little boost in Democratic voter turnout. A lot of these special elections, as you know, sometimes are not very well, the voters are just not aware of them. They can happen in an odd month, you know, compared to regular elections. And so the voters aren't looking for them. They're not accustomed to them. And, the majority of voters out there are not the ones like me and our volunteers that are news junkies and reading about it. And we follow this stuff, even though it's not in our state. Most voters have very busy lives and just are not able to, you know, to just keep tabs on all these special elections that seem to be popping up, you know, almost every month now. So that's what we feel we can do. We can catch their attention conveniently at their mailbox with a, you know, just a homespun, authentic, handwritten postcard. It's not negative. We don't trash talk the opponent. It's a positive, friendly reminder to go vote. And by the way, here's here's who's running, the Democrat that's running that we support.
Looking at your website, I mean, the cards, some of them, besides being pleasantly low tech, I mean, for people who don't spend all their time online, basically, some are downright whimsical. They're beautiful and colorful. People put a lot of themselves into these.
That was such a surprise to see when this began back in March of 2017 for the primary in the Georgia 6th Congressional District, the one where Jen Ossoff ran. One of the most surprising things that I saw was what you just described, how people, without being asked to do so, I never gave any instructions about coloring or highlighting or drawing or art or craftivism, which is what some people call it. All I did was give them some guidelines on what to say and the addresses, and please, you know, mail it promptly. You know, don't wait too long to mail it after you write it. And that was pretty much it. And people would share photographs on Facebook and on Twitter and on Instagram, and we feature, you know, some of them, and we try to trade them out on our website to showcase new ones that we get all the time. But you're right, people have put in some incredible talent into this that I am in awe of every time I see a new one. How long did that take you? But you know, it goes back again to the fact that we're not asking them to do 1,000 postcards a person or anything unreasonable like that. Do only as many as you have time and postage to spare. And with our numbers, that will all add up. So you don't have to feel badly that you could only do 5. That's fine. 5 times 1,000 people, that's 5,000 postcards. You know, so it's okay.
A small house race in Iowa, right, where you don't have that many people basically who are going, right, to be voting in the first place, that can make a huge difference, because when they had that recent Senate race here that opened up this House seat, really it was basically if they could have got out, you know, 500 more people on the other side, it could have changed the whole race.
I cringe a little when you mention that, because we weren't invited to help with that campaign, and we would have loved to have helped. We did write for Dr. Phil Miller in Iowa earlier in the election year last year, and he won by a very healthy margin in a district that went for Trump. So I don't remember off the top of my head what the percentage was that the district went for Trump. But he ended up winning, which was really nice. And we heard some lovely stories from the Democratic voters in the area that the cards just started coming in from all corners of the country. They weren't expecting it. You know, you never do, right? You're sitting at home and you get a postcard from out of state, and the first thought that goes through your head is, you know, who do I know that lives in Hawaii or wherever, you know, Pennsylvania? And then you start to read it and you realize what it is. And it's such an unusual thing to get in the mail. Usually these campaign pieces, they're glossy. They've been wordsmithed within an inch of their death by committees and marketers and campaign experts. Yet here it is in your hands. This very clearly authentic, you know, worded, you know, by just the regular person, just like you, and just in a friendly way, asking you to remember to go vote. So I think it really is capturing people's imagination on both sides of that mail delivery. It's capturing the imaginations of the person writing it, where they're visualizing with each card they're writing, they're imagining what will it be like for that recipient to get their card? What will they do with it? Will this be enough to get them to go vote? And that's giving them the drive to write another one after that, and then another one after that. And it's capturing the imagination of the person who receives it. Who is this person on the other side of the country that cares enough about the outcome of my race here in Iowa that they took the time to write this and use their own money to put a stamp on it? I just feel so special to be part of what these volunteers have given life to. you know, I wouldn't be able to write all these postcards myself. It's because of them that this has gone on now in our 10th month. And we've written over 500,000 postcards in 42 different campaigns, which is just amazing.
That was Tony McMullen of Postcards to Voters. The group is targeting races where there's a high probability of a Democrat taking over a Republican seat. The 6th District Iowa House with Democratic candidate Rita DeYoung is one of those seats. DeYoung is a 64-year-old former Sioux City teacher and principal. She says her experience as a teacher, principal, and an advocate for children has given her the expertise to be an effective state leader.
I have lived all my life in Northwest Iowa. The last 4 decades, I've lived right here in the Sioux City area. During that time, I was a teacher, taught for 11 years. Then I went on to be a principal for the next 21 years. Currently, I'm working with a program that works with 14 to 24-year-olds, and the majority of them have been involved in the juvenile justice system, but our program is to help them get a high school diploma, receive training so that they can go on and get a job and then keep a job. And I am also mother of 2 grown children, 2 children that graduated, I'm proud to say, from Sioux City Schools. They went on, my daughter graduated from Northwestern College in Northern City, and my son graduated from University of Northern Iowa. And so feel that I was very fortunate for them to be Sioux City graduates and to be ready to be out in the world.
What was it that made you want to take on this run for office?
Well, truthfully, it was never on any of my list. However, the last few years, and in particular the 2017 session, I've been very concerned and frustrated with some of the decisions being made in Des Moines and how they are affecting all of Iowa, but and especially the Sioux City area. When I say Sioux City, I'm talking about Salix, Bronson, Sargent Bluff. Just the decisions that are being made, I do not think are helping our community. And so somebody needed to step up, and even though it was never my plan in the last 4 decades to do this, I really feel there's a need for someone to come up and be in Des Moines, voicing our opinions, voicing our concerns.
Are these issues education related?
They're kind of interwoven, my concerns. Education, yes, because it's not being funded at the level that it is required to by law, and it's been underfunded for a long time. But also I have concerns about workers' compensation, collective bargaining. I'm concerned about mental health. Iowa is actually the last in the nation for addressing mental health issues. 50th out of 50, dead last. We have 36 beds in the whole state of Iowa, 99 counties. Of that, 12 are for adolescents, 24 are for adults. And anytime there's an issue in our country, when there's a tragedy, they talk about mental health has to be addressed. And I don't feel that we as Iowans are taking care of that. In the last few years, we've closed down half of our mental health agencies. We've privatized Medicaid, and I'm on several boards, or I've been on several boards, and one in particular that is a real problem. It's made a mess in Des Moines with our budget, and it's just not providing the services that need to be provided. And when I say a mess, it's not just the young persons that need that help. The agencies are having difficulty. The parents are having difficulty. And the insurance companies are even having difficulty. So it's something that was done very quickly with not very much planning. And we're now dealing with the fallout of that.
It seems like even Republicans are now questioning the governor about the wisdom of making that move as quickly as it was made.
Definitely. I think it's something that's very clearly was a poor decision. Several things I feel in the last session, 2017 in particular, were poor decisions. But I can see firsthand as a board member with Boys and Girls Home and Family Services, when they turn in a request for payment for the services provided, it takes months and months to get that. And they aren't always reimbursed at the level that they should be. It's hurting the person that needs the service. It's hurting the agencies, the community at large, and even the insurance companies. So that was a decision that was made very quickly, I feel very quickly, without the right amount of research.
Last year, the collective bargaining for public employees in Iowa was very much gutted, and this has affected public employees, including teachers. You spent a long time in education as a teacher, as a principal. What could be done? Is there anything that could be done now to improve that situation, or is that ship sailed?
Well, I don't have a specific plan on how to bring that back, but I do believe that it can come back. It just needs to be a case of there needs to be enough people that see that as a priority. I don't believe that anything is completely gone, something as good as collective bargaining, and even workers' compensation, just because it was written out. And it actually was done very quickly and kind of dark of night, and people who were directly affected by that didn't know anything about it until after it had happened. And I think it was a case that, yes, collective bargaining could be looked at again, and probably with the right person representing different areas of Iowa, enough support, it would be written the way it should be.
Seems like this year lawmakers are pretty serious about doing something about water quality in Iowa. A couple of different bills are floated out there. I imagine that's something you're interested in as well.
Yes, I think the water quality, it's awful that Iowa's a great place to live. I love Iowa. And if we have over half of our water systems being affected with negatively, we need to do something about it. And I think any time you have a group of people that say it's a priority, it seems to be taken care of. I feel the same thing about water quality as with education. If it's truly a priority, then we wouldn't be gutting it. We wouldn't be mistreating it. We would be giving it the source of income or attention that it needs.
If you were elected, you would definitely be going back to a situation much like the situation last year, a very partisan situation. Republicans are pretty much running the show. What do you think Democrats can do in the House and the Senate?
Well, you're definitely right. We have a Republican governor, a Republican majority Senate and House. However, we need to make steps in that direction to have it be more balanced. First of all, as a teacher and a principal, there's lots of times you have to be in difficult situations. You have to listen to people. There's nothing wrong with compromising. I feel that a compromise usually ends up in a win-win situation, and that's what we need to do. We need to really go back and look what our citizens of Iowa, and in my case, House District 6, what they need and what solutions they're looking for.
Jim Carlin had this seat before, and now he's going to the state senate. And I know there's a group that's helping you out with a little kind of low-tech postcard campaign. They've chosen your election to try and get a Democrat back in that seat.
That's correct. I was made aware of that, and it's very interesting. This is a group of volunteers, as you said. We have course don't have the money that some campaigns have, but they're very excited about writing postcards to voters in Northwest Iowa, particularly House District 6, and they just their postcards are handmade, of course. They provide their own postcard and they provide the postage, but they feel that strongly that they want somebody in Iowa that's going to be listening to the people of Iowa.
And that that organization says they pick seats where they feel like it might be one they could flip from Republican to Democrat, that must make you feel good.
Yes, it's very exciting to see that they're interested in this, not only interested, but willing to take the time. Because, you know, when they fill out a postcard, they spend, there's a group down in Florida that was doing it, but there's local persons as well. And it's kind of exciting to get a postcard, but you're right. This would be a time when we need to stop looking at necessarily at Republican, Democrat, but look at who's the right person with the best experience that has done this work before. I feel passionate about the issues, and I also am willing to do the hard work because it will be hard work. The education is obviously important to me. The mental health and just generally having access to health care. I know that it's very easy for persons to say that, but when you've actually lived and have to work with persons that are needing these services, I think it gives you a different feel than just saying, oh, yes, I care about furthering education or I want accessible health care. When you actually live day to day working with these citizens, I think it gives a different taste to it.
That was Rita DeYoung, the Democratic candidate in the 6th District special election being held next Tuesday. Her opponent is Jacob Bossman. The Republican Sioux Cityan is 37 years old and a longtime aide to U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley. Bossman narrowly lost to Jim Carlin in the 2016 primary for the Republican spot on the ballot for that House District 6 seat. Bossman says he would like to use his expertise in finance to deal with the ongoing issues with the state budget deficits. He says part of the problem has to do with flawed revenue estimates.
The first issue we need to address is the REC, the Revenue Estimating Conference. We need to reform that in a way that they're able better able to project what the revenues really are going to be. And I don't know if they need to make more conservative, small c, not big C, the ways they project that, because if you project less and you have a surplus, that's great. But for the last couple of years, they've projected more. And the issue is we're setting our budgets based on these projections. And if you promise somebody a 4% increase and you have to then come back and say, no, actually, you're not getting an increase, you're only getting 1%. Like you said, that does amount to a cut because they've planned for that. So the money hasn't been there, but I think the bigger issue is just the stability, the projection. We need to be able to more transparently say, this is what you're getting. And I think most agencies, most people I've talked to have said, if you tell us we're going to get 1%, we can plan for that, especially if it's not a long-term thing as far as an increase. But if you tell people it's going to be 2 or 3% and then you have to come back and reduce it to 1, that's a big issue because you've maybe hired somebody, you've maybe planned something, expanded a program. So I think we need a system where we can better project, more accurately project what it's going to be so that people can plan and we can stick to that. But I think kind of to your point, a lot of the issues that we talk about in the campaign really come down to the budget. If we can get the budget back in order, whether it's implementing sound budgeting practices and not relying on, the rainy day funds. If we can, talk about tax reform, even if not cuts, just simplification where we are in South Dakota, where we can get maybe some of those businesses or people that have moved, even if we can't get them to move back from the Dakota Dunes, just the ones here who maybe are thinking about moving to the Dakota Dunes to stay, that if the budget situation is straightened out, that really alleviates a lot of the pressure on the budgets of education and mental health, and then we maybe have the resources where we can focus on some of those priorities.
Do you think that it's possible to figure out a way to make the state more attractive to businesses, especially here, because you're talking about Dakota Dunes, yeah. People moving there, people moving across to Nebraska?
Yep, that's a big thing, and I think that in Des Moines, we need a representative who can have a strong voice to articulate that, because I think a lot of times the representatives in Des Moines don't understand that. Where I've heard, I was down in the Capitol in 03 where they were talking about the cigarette tax, and maybe not the greatest example, but they were talking about how if we increase the tax, people have to pay it because where are they going to go? Nobody from Des Moines is going to drive to Missouri to buy cigarettes. But in Sioux City, that's a completely different situation.
Some of our biggest cities are on rivers.
Yep. And so it is amazing that a lot of the people in Des Moines don't think that way, but especially for Sioux City, when you have South Dakota that has 0% personal income tax and 0% corporate income tax, that's a big deal. And our corporate income tax rate in Iowa is the highest in the country. We're at just under 12%. Second highest, Pennsylvania, is at 10. It's quite a bit lower. And so when you have South Dakota that's zero, it really puts us at a disadvantage, and not to mention the individual income tax rate. So I don't feel like we need to be zero to compete with them, because the people that are here, we have the amenities here, a lot of the jobs are here, Orpheum and their friends and family. And so when people sell their house and move to the dunes, that takes some effort. So I feel like if we were just more competitive, and I would propose something like doing away with federal deductibility, because that lowers our rate, but we still look uncompetitive. Our highest income tax rate is 9%, even though it's probably closer to 7% with the federal deductibility. It looks much worse. But if we would do away with that and simplify the brackets, because right now we have 9 brackets, a lot of times people don't even understand our tax system and don't even want to look at it. But if we could simplify something like 0, 2, 4, 6, maybe go to 4 brackets, which with a much lower top bracket, I think that makes us look competitive to the point where if somebody wants to come to Sioux City, move their business here or move themselves here, and they look at that versus the zero in South Dakota, maybe we have the other amenities and positives and benefits of our community that can sort of make up that difference. Whereas right now, I think what we're seeing is the 9% just isn't doing that. They look at the top corporate tax bracket at 12 and the top income tax bracket at 9, and they look at South Dakota at 0 and they say, you know, I'm willing to maybe live over there and drive in or try to recruit my customers over there because of that big difference. So I don't think we need to be exactly the same as South Dakota to compete, because we have a lot of things going for us over here that they don't. We just need to, I think, be simpler. And right now, like you said, with the budget, there's a lot of budget issues, deficit issues, spending issues. There's not a lot of money right now. And I consider myself a budget hawk. I'm not going to talk about tax cuts that are going to put our state in a bad financial position. But simplification, even revenue neutral, where we could say, you know, we're going to just simplify the number of tax codes. We're going to do away with federal deductibility, because a lot of people from outside the state don't understand that. And then another issue I just read about this morning was Iowa has federal deductibility where you can deduct your federal taxes, corporate and personal. And with those tax rates lowering, they're projecting next year $16 million more in income to the state of Iowa, because it's less taxes that people can deduct from their Iowa, so they're paying more Iowa taxes. And then they said the next year as much as $100 million. So I feel like that's money that we could use then for tax reform, where we could say, this is money we weren't collecting before, now we're collecting just because you're not deducting as much from your federal taxes, and so we'll use that maybe to simplify the rates. So I think that's something we need to look into, is, like I said, really just the simplification, making it easier to understand and more attractive from that perspective, especially because we border on South Dakota. And I think the counties north of here that border on South Dakota, especially closer to Sioux Falls, would experience the same thing.
The privatization of Medicaid has got a lot of people upset. They're saying people aren't getting services. They can't afford services. So they can't even find someone to take care of them. We have one private provider now in the state of Iowa. Part of this is sort of a hangover from Obamacare. What do you think the state should do? Because some people say the state should step in and take it over again. Other people say we need a stopgap measure. We need to make it more attractive for the private insurers to be part of this.
Yeah, so you're talking about the privatization of Medicaid in Iowa. My understanding from having talked to the Community Health Center and some other people is that there are some of those businesses that work well with them. And there was of the three, there was at least one, maybe a couple that really didn't. So I do think that's kind of settling itself out, except the issue you're running into is it was set up as a system where there was competition, and you don't want to go to a system where there's not. So I think right now you're seeing at least being tossed around the idea of maybe the state stepping in and doing kind of the way they were before, where the state ran all of Medicaid. And so in that system, there wasn't the competition either. But if you had a one or two private companies and the state, I think that might balance out the system in the way that it was intended. The other issue you're running into, I just read about this morning too, actually, was that they projected a certain amount of savings because of the managed care organizations. And I think that they said they were estimating close to $250 million in savings for this year. I think it might be the $50 million for the first year. And it's only, they're saying $47 million is what it'll end up saving. So that's an issue that obviously $47 million in savings is nothing to sneeze at. But if you're, again, what I talked about with the budget, if you had factored into your budget and are projecting and basing everything else based on this $250 million in savings, and you're getting 50, that's a big deficit. So I think a bigger issue is just to have realistic expectations as far as what healthcare in general costs in Iowa. It is a priority for me, and I think most legislators, that we need to take care of the people on Medicaid. We need to help people with mental health issues and autism, that those need to be priorities, and we need to be, I think, maybe realistic.
That was Jacob Bossman, the Republican candidate for the 6th District State House seat based in Siouxland. The special election for that seat is next Tuesday, January 16th. You're listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. And now we hear from Siouxland Public Media's Allie Carson as she takes a walk around the Sioux City Arts Center.
When families come in, we watch more the mothers and fathers sort of pulling the kids around and trying to engage them in the artworks. In this one, I think it's the opposite. It's the kids pulling whoever's brought them so they can talk about what they've seen.
That's curator Todd Behrens at the Sioux City Arts Center talking about crafting tradition, Oaxacan wood carvings. He met me in the third floor gallery and let me lead him around with a microphone clipped to his tie.
He got me on a leash.
I do have you on a leash. Okay, I want to start with this one because this one is titled the Alabrije.
Right.
And that's really what all of these are, but this one just happens to have that specific title.
Right. So it's... The sculptures in this exhibition have become classified, called Alabrije, and there's a long story connected to that. On the full title for this piece, there's a parenthetical title that's inspired by papier-mâché figures of Linares family of Mexico City, and it was the Linares family that first created something that became known as Alabrije. Back in the 1930s, during the heyday of Mexican surrealism, a young member of the Linares family was ill and was kind of going in and out of consciousness and had some really strange dreams. And one of the dreams, there were these fantastic morphed animal figures, and they were just surrounding him and jumping up and down, and they were all screaming the same word at him, Alabrije. It's not anything that means anything. It was just a nonsense word. And so when he became well, he still had this deep memory of this bizarre dream. And his attempt at working through that was to try to bring these things to life. And so he used papier-mâché to create what his memory still held in terms of these bizarre animal figures. And he called them Alabrije.
Yes, and this one is
absolutely
a little bizarre.
So this might be like, I'm not sure, there are many pieces in the show that it might be the showstopper, but this one is certainly the most bizarre. Because first of all, you cannot possibly identify what animal he might have started at. This guy has some crazy gnarly teeth. He has wings. He has horns. He has some other things that might be horns or some kind of plates coming out of the top of his head. Slightly webbed feet, kind of webbed paw hands, and a multicolored tail. But every little part has a different palette and a different type of patterning going on. And this sort of exemplifies what has become a common thing in the state of Oaxaca. Literally small communities in Oaxaca have created these wood sculptures almost now as their primary manufacturing base, selling to tourists, selling to galleries, and in some cases selling to the University of Iowa, which is where this collection comes from. It's exciting that we get to have, well, I don't know, about two dozen of them here for another couple of weeks.
Crafting Tradition Oaxacan Wood Carvings will be on display through Sunday, January 21st. Then the space will be cleared out to make way for Icons, Elizabethans, and Elegies for a Mad King, paintings by Steve Joy.
He is from England, or born in England,
yeah,
in 1952, now living in Omaha, or has a studio in Omaha.
Right.
All right, so can you tell me a little bit about Steve Joy's style and kind of just a little bit about what people can expect to see next?
Steve is, as you mentioned, he's born in England, but he is, as much as anyone can be, a man of the world. There are lots of people who travel, who have been to country after country after country. Steve has lived in country after country after country. I mean, genuinely lived, worked, studied, made art in all parts of Europe, South Asia, East Asia, New York City, and Council Bluffs in Omaha. His art is beautiful and mysterious. It has this ability to, it's thoroughly abstract.
Okay.
So it is one of those things where if you look at it and you're trying to find something, you're probably not going to find something.
You won't see Queen Elizabeth. There
are Queen Elizabeth paintings.
That it's titled Queen Elizabeth. Mm-hmm. But you
and
cannot
Henry VIII,
like identify, and you know, you wouldn't be like,
won't.
Oh, that's her face.
Probably not, because he's looking at art.
Yes.
For inspiration, as opposed to Elizabeth for inspiration.
Yeah, yeah.
He uses bold colors. He incorporates a lot of metal leafs, so gold leaf, silver leaf, copper leaf sometimes. And then he also uses wax, either just regular wax or beeswax in some cases, to give his paintings this light, this glow. You know, they are beautiful in the way that jewelry can be beautiful, but many of his paintings can be quite large. I know we have one of the paintings coming in is going to be 9 feet wide. By 6 or 7 feet tall.
Okay.
So not exactly a jewel, but they have that brilliance that makes you look at them.
Yeah, so definitely something to come see in person.
Yeah.
I've been talking to Todd Behrens at the Sioux City Art Center about current and upcoming exhibitions. More details can be found online at siouxcityartcenter.org. For Siouxland Public Media, I'm Ellie Carson.